quickly to let it pass. Then, before we knew it, the car door opened and Steve swung inside. He opened a small compartment in the dashboard and tucked a printed card inside. He then started the car and checked his mirror.
"Okay, Yuri Geller," said Steve, pulling a neat 180 in the middle of the road. "Time to do your stuff."
The foundation was smaller than Steve had been expecting. He had anticipated something on the scale of a university or hospital, but it turned out to be a fairly modest building with white walls and a terracotta-tiled roof. There was a large red sign to the side of the building, 201 James Randi Educational Foundation. They were met in the reception area by a tall man in a red shirt.
"Simon?" ventured the man, glancing down at his watch. "Your right arm... Geez, what happened to you?"
he exclaimed when he raised his head to look at Simon properly. Steve interjected before Simon could say a thing.
"Kids and motorbikes, what can you say?" he said with an awkward laugh.
"Yeah, sure,"
said the man distractedly. Then to Simon,
"You okay? Can we get you anything?"
"No thanks, I'm fine," said Simon.
His smile looked painful and lopsided. His black eye and swollen nose gave him the appearance of having been recently mugged. He held out one bandaged hand.
"It's Jeff, isn't it?"
"Yes,"
said Jeff, shaking Simon's hand somewhat gingerly.
"Jeff Wagg. I'm the general manager here at JREF.
"This is Steve Brennus," said Simon. "He'll be accompanying me for the challenge."
"Steve,"
said Jeff, turning to shake Steve's hand.
"Welcome to Florida."
Then, turning back to Simon, he said,
"Are you sure you're okay? We can always postpone the challenge."
"No,
I'm fine, really,"
insisted Simon.
"We can go ahead as planned."
"If you're sure,"
said Jeff, adjusting his glasses. Simon nodded, and Jeff finally allowed himself to be convinced.
"Well, come on in then,"
he said, ushering them into the building. Simon and Steve followed Jeff into a large room lined with well-stocked bookshelves. There was a sign beside the doorway that read, "Isaac Asimov Library." A large glass table dominated the center of the room, and the far wall featured a brick and tile fireplace, surrounded by what looked like certificates or awards and pictures of people that Steve did not recognize.
"Grab a seat,"
said Jeff, indicating a couple of chairs at the near end of the table.
"Make yourselves at home."
Simon and Steve hovered by the chairs.
"Now, can I get you a coffee or anything?"
asked Jeff.
"Coffee would be great,"
said Steve.
"Thanks."
Jeff was barely gone a minute when he returned with a tray, carrying a flask of coffee and two cups. In addition to this, he had a clipboard tucked under one arm. He placed the tray on the table before them.
"Randi will be here in a few minutes,"
he said, filling the two cups. "He's just finishing up with a call." Simon nodded as Jeff placed a cup of steaming coffee in front of him.
"He's quite keen to meet you, Simon," continued Jeff. "In fact, you created quite a bit of interest here."
"Oh?" said Simon, raising his cup to take a sip.
"Absolutely," said Jeff. "This is the first time that anyone is actually going to take the challenge. No one else has ever got past the preliminary testing stage."
"Simon passed the preliminary tests?" asked Steve.
"Not exactly," clarified Jeff, "but we were sufficiently impressed to agree to these special conditions."
Here he tapped the clipboard that he had placed on the table.
"Really?"
said Steve, giving Simon a meaningful look.
"That's right," said Jeff, looking at Simon. "Even the amazing James Randi couldn't figure out how you did it. I think that's why he's so keen to sit in on this one."
Simon just smiled innocently.
"Simon,"
said a voice suddenly from the doorway. Simon and Steve turned as a bald man with glasses and a bushy, stark white beard entered the room. He walked with a slightly hunched gait, but seemed animated by a youthfulness that belied his stately years.
"Mr. Randi,"
said Simon, putting his coffee down and rising from his chair.
"Please, just Randi,"
said Randi, shaking Simon's hand gently.
His gaze took in, assimilated, and decided not to comment on Simon's injuries with startling swiftness.
"You must be Steve," said Randy, turning to greet Steve. "Simon said you might be joining him."
"That's right," said Steve, resisting the urge to cast an accusing glance at Simon. He reached out to take Randy's hand, and as he did so, he looked into the man's vaguely familiar face, a friendly face with a mischievous twinkle in his shrewd eyes.
"Please, take a seat, finish your coffee," said Randy, gesturing everyone towards the table.
"I have to tell you, I've been looking forward to this afternoon, hoping you'd be able to make it."
To Steve, Simon seemed strangely self-conscious, and he wondered if he was having second thoughts about the challenge.
"I must admit to being more than a little intrigued," said Randy, taking a seat at the table. "Your performance over the phone was really quite impressive."
Simon smiled. Randy nodded sagely, a small smile on his lips, and Steve did not need psychic abilities to know what that smile meant. It was one thing to hoodwink someone over the phone, but to do it face to face, under carefully controlled conditions, was something else entirely. Steve hoped that Simon was not about to make a fool of himself.
"Well," said Randy, as the pause in conversation began to stretch, "we're just waiting for Lionel, the JREF lawyer, to get here. Then we can begin."
He turned to Jeff.
"Is that the protocol?"
"That's it," said Jeff. He pushed the clipboard across the table as he, too, took a seat.
Randy took the clipboard and scanned the first page, nodding as he quickly read it through. He turned to the second page and shook his head as he laid it down.
"Most interesting," he said, taking his glasses off to give them a quick polish. "Most unusual."
Steve did his best not to seem too intrigued. Sitting on the opposite side of the table, Jeff Wagg nodded in agreement with the JRF's founder, and picking up on Steve's curiosity, he offered a brief explanation.
"Normally people state the psychic ability that they're going to attempt," he said.
"And Simon hasn't told you?"
asked Steve, glancing at Simon and back to the other men.
"Simon gave us a choice of about 10 so-called psychic powers," said Randy, shaking his head and laughing softly at Simon's audacity. "He invited us to choose one for the challenge."
Steve turned to stare at Simon, and the expression on his face could not have been clearer.
"Are you mad?"
"And which one did you choose?"
asked Steve, wondering how they could get out of there before the embarrassment began.
"We call it the Spoonbender's Nemesis," said Randy.
Steve ran his fingers across his brow. He glanced at Simon, who gave him a small shrug that seemed to say,
"Don't look at me, I didn't choose it."
Jeff reached into the top pocket of his shirt and pulled out a small glass tube, maybe 10 centimeters long, sealed at either end with a red plastic stopper. Inside, the tube was a metal rod of almost the same length as the tube. Jeff handed the tube to Randy.
"Bending spoons is one of the easiest psychic feats to explain," said Randy, "but there are still plenty of believers out there."
He held up the glass tube so that everyone could clearly see it.
"This challenge is simple," he went on, "to bend the metal rod without touching it, using only the power of your mind."
He gave the tube a little shake.
"The fact that it's enclosed in a sealed glass tube tends to put most people off."
Steve exchanged another loaded glance with Simon.
"Ah, Lionel," said Randy suddenly, as a gray-haired man in a smart suit was led into the room by a younger member of the JREF staff.
Randy got up from his chair and introduced the Foundation's lawyer to Simon and Steve.
"And this is Tony," Randy went on. "Rich normally videos the tests, but he has another engagement this afternoon, so Tony will be recording the challenge for us today."
With a brief nod of introduction, Tony turned on the video camera and moved to the corner of the room to get the best angle for covering the challenge. As he did so, Simon caught Steve's eye, and the meaning in his eyes could not have been clearer.
"He's the one." Trying not to make it too obvious, Steve gave Tony a more appraising glance. So, this was the mole in the JRAF camp. He nodded his understanding to Simon and sat back down on the couch. There was no pulling out now, the game was afoot. Okay, said Randy, when everyone was seated at the table. He pushed the clipboard back to Jeff, who pulled a pen from his shirt pocket and offered it to Simon. If you could just read this through, he said, everything should be as we discussed. One challenge, one psychic ability of our choosing. Simon took the clipboard and gave the form a cursory once-over, as Jeff continued. The rod is currently straight as a die, said Jeff, taking the tube back from Randy and holding it up for everyone to see. If, at the end of 15 minutes, the rod remains straight, then the challenge will be deemed a fail. Simon looked up from the clipboard and gave Jeff an affirmative nod. If, after 15 minutes, the rod has been bent, to the satisfaction of representatives from JREF, without Simon ever having touched it, then the challenge will be considered a success, and the $1 million prize will be transferred to the claimant's account. Jeff paused for everyone to absorb this summary of agreed conditions. As requested by today's claimant, he held out his hand to indicate Simon. In the event of a successful challenge, the results of the challenge will not be disclosed by JREF for the period of 5 days from today, after which representatives from JREF will be invited to attend a press conference at the BBC studios in Manchester, England, a press conference at which the claimant may or may not be present. Here Steve looked pointedly at Simon. In this, at least, he was the only person in the room to fully appreciate the finer points of this clause. While Jeff read out the particulars of the protocol, Randy watched Simon with a penetrating gaze. He had seen all manner of people turning up to attempt the $1 million challenge, but he had never met anyone quite like Simon. There was no bravado, no apparent nervousness, no suggestion of excuses or misgivings creeping into the procedure. Simon just sat there, holding the clipboard, while Jeff read out the particulars. Despite his absolute conviction about the truth of paranormal phenomena, Randy's sense of anticipation had never been greater. So, Simon, said Jeff in conclusion, if you could just sign both copies of the protocol, here and here. Simon signed his name and handed the clipboard back to Jeff. And I will sign it on behalf of JREF, said Jeff, adding his name to the contract. Then we can begin. Jeff looked around at all those present to check that everyone was in agreement. Then he set the glass tube down on the table in front of Simon and settled back in his chair. It is now 2:50 p.m., he said. Simon, when you're ready. Here he looked at Simon, who gave him a simple nod. You have 15 minutes. With that, Jeff pressed the timer on his watch, and all eyes fell on the glass tube and the metal rod that lay sealed within. The Spoonbender's Nemesis. Chapter 14. For a minute or so, Simon just sat there. No one was looking at him. All eyes were on the small glass tube and the metal rod that lay inside. He felt a faint shiver of nervousness. Not uncertainty or doubt, more like a kind of stage fright. A singer who was just about to give a public performance, where before they had only ever sung alone. He found himself wishing that his mum and dad were there, and although he did not believe in life after death, he could almost feel their presence beside him. Do what you have to do. Well, this was part of it. There'd be no going back from this. Simon was about to give up his anonymity, about to expose himself to the perilous vagaries of public opinion. As the minutes went by and nothing happened, people began to glance up at him, their expressions betraying a mixture of anticipation, doubt, and sympathy. And yet, interestingly to Simon, there was no sense of condescension, no sense of judgment. At one point, Simon caught Randy's eye, and the two men held each other's gaze for a moment. Another minute went by, and the camera, operated by Tony, began to focus more and more on Simon. Lionel, the JREF lawyer, had settled back in his chair, clearly convinced that nothing was going to happen, and Randy's face seemed to convey something akin to disappointment. He could put it off no longer. Simon took a breath. From the small glass tube there came the tiniest of sounds, the barely audible tick of a seal being broken. Suddenly, all eyes were glued to the table. There followed a collective suspension of breath as the red plastic stopper began to ease its way out of the tube.
"Fuck me,"
breathed Tony, quietly, as he adjusted the camera zoom to make sure he did not miss a thing. Then everyone jumped, as, with a small pop, the plastic stopper came free. Hardly able to believe his eyes, Steve looked up at Simon, who was calmly gazing down at the table. Then Steve's eyes were drawn down once more as the metal rod began to move. The rod slid clear of the tube and lay unmoving on the table. The JREF lawyer was no longer lounging back in his chair. Like everyone else, he was sitting forward, straining to catch any movement, no matter how small. Then, without anyone touching it, without anyone coming near to touching it, the metal rod began to bend. Steve's heart was pounding in his chest. Once more, he looked up from the astonishing scene unfolding before them, only to find Simon staring directly at him. He was not even looking at the rod. Simon was doing the impossible, and he was not even looking at it. And then it occurred to Steve. "This is easy for him," he thought. "He's doing the impossible, and it's easy." Simon just held his gaze. And now, for the first time, Steve understood the expression that lurked behind Simon's eyes. That knowing, self-assured expression that made him seem so much older than his years. "God," thought Steve, with a sudden understanding. "He's never told anyone. What kind of person does it take to live with something like this and never tell a soul? He must be the loneliest person alive." For a few seconds more, the two men just looked at each other. Then slowly, they became aware of people talking excitedly, and Simon lowered his eyes. The James Randi $1 million psychic challenge had been accomplished, and the world would never be the same again. In the hubbub of excitement that followed, Steve found himself becoming increasingly annoyed and protective of Simon. How did he do it? Would he take another test? Could he really perform all 10 of the psychic abilities he listed? Was there any way he could extend his stay in Fort Lauderdale? But as the pressure increased, it was James Randi who came to their rescue. "Enough," he had said, with quiet authority. "That's enough." "But Randi," said the JREF lawyer. "No," said Randi. "But we can't just," began Tony. "Gentlemen, please," said Randi more firmly, ushering his colleagues to the far end of the room. He turned to Simon and Steve. "A moment, please," he said, with a wry smile. Simon nodded and sat back down at the table. Steve remained standing. "What do you think is the problem?" he asked quietly. Simon looked down the room to where the members of the JREF staff were talking in hushed and occasionally heated voices. Every now and then, one of them would glance up at the two British men before returning to the huddle. "They're trying to decide if they can honor the contract," replied Simon.
"You mean they're not going to pay up?"
"No," said Simon. "The money isn't the problem."
"Then what is it?"
asked Steve. "Keeping a lid on this for the next 5 days," explained Simon. "That's what they agreed to," said Steve with annoyance. "Easily done when you don't believe it will happen," said Simon. Steve's derisive snort told exactly what he thought of people who reneged on a deal. Finally, Randy broke from the group and returned to Steve and Simon, who stood to meet him. "Please accept my apologies, gentlemen," he said as he approached. "It would seem that the extraordinary events of the day almost got the better of us." He stepped up to Simon and reached out to take his hand, holding it gently in both of his. "I've spent a good many years inviting people to prove the existence of paranormal phenomena. I never believed they would," he said. Simon gave a small apologetic smile. "It is my deepest privilege that you came here to prove me wrong, and I am profoundly honored. Thank you."
"You're welcome," said Simon shyly.
Randy nodded. The smile and the twinkle had returned to his eyes. He turned to the members of his staff. "Tony, if you could put the disc from the camera in a sealed envelope and pass it to Jeff, he will place it in the company safe." A disgruntled Tony seemed suddenly protective of the camera, but he nodded his agreement as he left the room. "Jeff, I wonder if you could check out flights to the UK. I understand there's a press conference being held at the BBC that we wouldn't want to miss." Finally, he turned to the JREF lawyer. "Lionel, if you please, I believe we have some formalities to attend to. I trust you bought the necessary papers."
"Yes, yes," said Lionel, reaching for his briefcase. He opened the case and withdrew several official-looking documents.
"Simon, if you please," said Randy, inviting Simon to join them. Steve stepped back as Simon went to join the two men at the far end of the table.
"Basically," said Lionel, laying the documents out on the desk, "we just need your signature and the details of the bank account into which you'd like the money to be paid."
Steve could not suppress a smile as he watched Simon bend forward to sign the claimant's document. He felt strangely proud of Simon, pleased for him, but at the same time he felt unbelievably foolish. Something he had said just 2 days ago kept repeating itself in his mind.
"And I've already told you, I don't believe in psychics."
He laughed softly and looked down at the empty glass tube that still lay on the table. And beside it, a metal rod that was not only bent, but had been formed into a perfect circle. Steve reached down and picked up the circle of steel. He weighed it in the palm of his hand. As he did so, the smile faded from his face. He turned to look once more at Simon. If this one unbelievable thing were true, then how much more of what Simon had told him was also true? At some point in the next few days, a serial murderer was going to kill Simon, unless Steve killed him first. Tony sat at the computer in his office, the video camera cradled in his lap, a mobile phone pressed to his ear.
"No, I'm not joking," he hissed into the phone. "I just saw it with my own fucking eyes."
Tony cast a nervous glance at the door, clearly anxious that no one should hear him making this call.
"So the prize has been claimed," said a man's voice on the other end of the line.
"The foundation is actually paying up?" "They're signing the paperwork as we speak," said Tony quietly. "I'm telling you, this is for real."
"And you've got it all on film?"
"On disc, yes," said Tony. "I'm making a copy right now."
Tony's computer was all set to copy the disc from the camera, but despite Tony repeatedly pressing the eject button, the camera wouldn't give up the disc.
"Okay," said the man on the other end of the phone. "Do you know where they're staying?"
"No," said Tony, in growing frustration at the uncooperative camera.
"They said something about heading up to the Cape."
"All right, try and keep them there as long as possible."
"There's nothing I can do to stop them. Just send a car as soon as possible."
"There's one on its way, but it's not that simple. We can't detain them without authorization."
"Authorization from who?"
asked Tony.
"Our client,"
came the evasive reply.
"Whatever," said Tony. "They're driving a blue Chevy Cobalt. It's parked right outside the JREF, but I don't know how long they'll be there."
Tony struck the camera with the heel of his hand. The damn thing just wouldn't open.
"What is it?"
asked Steve when Simon hesitated in the Foundation's foyer. For the last few minutes, Simon had seemed distracted and distant.
"It's Tony," said Simon quietly. "He's trying to make a copy of the disc."
"What?" exclaimed Steve. "We should stop him. Tell Randy."
"It's okay," said Simon with a smile. "He's having a little trouble with the camera." For a moment, Steve just looked at him. Then,
"No,"
he said incredulously.
"It's just a simple electrical switch," said Simon, as if this explained everything. "But you're not even in the same room," protested Steve.
"Same room, same city. Distance doesn't really matter."
"What?" said Steve. "You can see through his eyes?"
"Not exactly," replied Simon. "But having met him, having made that connection, it almost allows me to be present in the room."
The intensity of Steve's frown adequately portrayed the difficulty he was having with these new revelations. He just kept thinking,
"This is not possible. None of this is possible."
Tony's head snapped up as Jeff entered the room.
"Is there a problem?" asked Jeff suspiciously when he saw the guilt written on Tony's face.
"No," said Tony, his face flushing. "Just can't seem to get the disc out."
Jeff stepped forward and held out his hand. With visible reluctance, Tony surrendered the camcorder to Jeff, who turned it over and pressed the eject button. There was a small click, and the caddy popped smoothly open.
"A case," said Jeff, nodding to the stack of DVD cases on Tony's desk. Tony opened a case and held it out to Jeff, who slipped the disc inside and folded it shut. Then he handed the camera back to Tony and left the room. Back in the foyer, Steve watched as Simon's face relaxed into a smile.
"Can we go now?" he asked.
"Yes," said Simon, "we can go." Steve shook his head, muttering under his breath, but Simon caught the words.
"Bloody psychics," Steve cursed as they made their way out to the blue Chevy Cobalt in the car park.
Chapter 15. The silver Volvo pulled up 100 meters from the entrance to the James Randi Foundation. The windows were darkly tinted, but apart from that, there was nothing to mark this vehicle out from several others parked in the driveways along the road. The two men inside sat back in their seats. They had made good time getting there, and they were relieved to see that the blue Chevy was still in the car park. It was an Avis rental, standard low-end model. Following it should be a piece of cake. They made a note of the license plate, called it into control, and settled down to wait.
"I don't get it," said the younger of the two men.
"We don't have to get it," said the older man. "We just have to follow them." He had the hard, serious face of an ex-cop.
"But really," persisted the younger man, "even if this guy can bend spoons without touching them, I mean, so what? We can tail him all the way to the Cape if need be. I don't see why we need the chopper."
The ex-cop seemed irritated by the simple act of having to make conversation.
"You wear a Ruger SR9 on your hip," he stated, without looking at his colleague.
"Yeah," said the younger man. "So what?
So you'd be happy sitting next to a man who could discharge that firearm just by looking at it?"
The younger man looked up sharply, his hand resting suddenly on the pistol at his waist.
"The contact said he could bend metal with his mind," he objected. "He said nothing about firing guns."
"If he can bend a steel rod into a perfect circle," snapped the ex-cop, "he can, sure as shit, slip a safety catch and apply the half ounce of pressure required to shoot you in your ass."
"Shit, I never thought of that. And who's to say he couldn't fuck with a car's engine or an airliner's?"
"Jesus," swore the younger man, looking at the blue Chevy with considerably more intensity than before.
"There's no telling what this guy's capable of," said the ex-cop. The conversation seemed to have annoyed him, and the look his colleague gave him did nothing to improve his temper. You think I'm paranoid, he said, taking in the younger man's sideways glance. I'm nothing compared to our client. There'll be none too pleased if we let this guy get away. That's why we need the chopper, to make sure there are no fuck-ups.
So you think they'll authorize us to detain him? I mean, they're not even American citizens.
The ex-cop just stared out of the Volvo's windscreen. Once they're convinced he's for real? Yes, they'll give us authorization. After all, he continued, it never stopped them with Werner von Braun, and just to think where we'd be without him.
Who? Asked the younger man, but the ex-cop was no longer listening.
He fired up the engine. Here they come, he said.
I see it, said Steve, as he pulled out of the James Randi car park. He did not need to be a psychic to pick out the silver Volvo down the street. Intuition was enough. He pulled onto Davy Boulevard, heading west. Simon felt a strong urge to turn round to see if the car was following them, but he contented himself with watching Steve's face as he kept a sharp eye on the rearview mirror. Here they come, said Steve when he saw the Volvo falling in behind them. He pursed his lips and gave a small nod of approval.
What is it?
Asked Simon. They're really keeping their distance, said Steve. Whoever's driving the car has done this before.
Can you lose them?
Steve looked across at him. Simon almost seemed to be enjoying this.
This isn't going to be some high-octane car chase, he said. Besides, he added, I don't want to lose them just yet.
Still driving calmly, Steve turned north onto South Andrews Avenue, heading away from the airport where, in just over 2 hours, they were due to catch a flight back to the UK. He continued north for about a mile, crossed over the river, then stopped at the traffic lights signaling right.
I take it you know what you're doing, asked Simon.
Just chill out, said Steve, bending forward at an awkward angle to look in his wing mirror. We need to see if your information is accurate.
Information about what?
About that, said Steve ominously. He reached out, adjusting the angle of the mirror to give him a better chance of keeping the approaching helicopter in sight. The lights changed to green and Steve went with the flow of traffic, palm trees and tall, pristine buildings lining the road.
I take it there's some point to this magical mystery tour, said Simon.
Steve shot Simon a sour look. First off, he said, as if he were lecturing some rookie on their first patrol. I need to make sure we're dealing with just the one tail. Plus, he added, I need to confirm that this chopper really is here for our benefit. That is not just some network bird covering downtown Fort Lauderdale. Simon smiled. He was not worried, not about this, at least.
Chopper's on the scene, came the female voice over the Volvo's radio.
Thanks, Control, said the ex-cop. We still have a visual on the target. Any word on authorization from the client?
That's a negative, Carwan,
stated the female voice firmly.
Brief remains, shadow and observe only.
Roger that, Control. Carwan out.
The younger of the two men gave an unimpressed grunt.
Would have been better if the contact had got a copy of that disc.
Well, he didn't, said the ex-cop. Just keep your mind on the job in hand. This guy seems like he's on some kind of sightseeing tour. They followed the blue Chevy as it meandered leisurely through Fort Lauderdale's more affluent districts. Then,
heads up, said the ex-cop suddenly. I think he's made us.
Okay, said Steve. That should do it. Simon felt himself pressed gently back in his seat as Steve suddenly accelerated away from the junction, not breaking the speed limit, just driving with more purpose than he had been for the last 10 minutes. They turned south and headed back over the river. The Volvo had now closed the distance in response to their increased speed, and still the chopper circled overhead. But Steve did not seem concerned. He knew what he needed to know. Simon became aware that they were heading back to where they'd started from. Up ahead was South Andrews Avenue, and there, coming up on the right, was the multi-story parking lot that Steve had disappeared into before they went to the James Randi Foundation.
With a quick glance in his mirror, Steve indicated right and turned into the lot. As they turned in, Simon took a quick glance behind them. The Volvo had come up fast and was now right behind them.
"Quick," said the younger man. "We don't want to lose them in there."
The ex-cop said nothing. He'd already gunned the accelerator. As he watched the Chevy enter the lot ahead of them, he wondered if the subjects were going to make a run for it on foot. Through the tight turns and gloomy interior of the lot, he kept the Chevy in view at all times. But instead of taking one of the numerous available spaces, the Chevy just headed straight for the exit. The Volvo followed. Simon did not like the claustrophobic feel of the parking lot, and was relieved when Steve headed for the exit. The Volvo was right on their tail. Any pretense about whether or not they were being followed had been abandoned. The chase was on. Or not, as it turned out. Steve braked suddenly as they reached the security barrier at the exit. He reached forward to the dashboard, opened a small compartment, and took out the printed card that he had placed in there earlier. Then, with a wink at Simon, he lowered his window and inserted the card into the column beside the car. The security barrier lifted before them, and Steve drove slowly through, only speeding up when the barrier dropped down behind them.
"Shit!"
cursed the ex-cop when he saw the security barrier rise up for the Chevy.
"Where did they get that ticket?"
protested the younger man. "We didn't see him stop."
"He didn't stop, you moron,"
snapped the ex-cop. "He'd already paid for the ticket." The younger man seemed puzzled as the security barrier came down in front of them. For a second, the ex-cop considered breaking through the barrier, but in addition to the barrier, he spotted a steel panel crossing the driveway ahead of them. They might get past the barrier, but that steel plate would flip up and stop the Volvo in its tracks. With an animal growl, he slammed the car in reverse, only to find the two cars were now sitting behind them, waiting to exit the lot. One of them honked its horn impatiently.
"For the love of God," swore the ex-cop.
Then, rummaging in his pocket, he fished out a handful of cash, thrusting it at the younger man, who seemed stunned at how quickly they'd got themselves into this predicament.
"Go find a ticket machine," he commanded, "and make it fucking quick," he added as the younger man jumped out of the car.
With a groan of angry frustration, the ex-cop thumbed the radio on the dashboard.
"Car one to control," he began.
"Go ahead, car one," said the familiar female voice.
"Control, we've lost them," he said heavily. "I repeat, we've lost them."
"Smooth, Mr. Brennus, very smooth," said Simon as they accelerated away from the parking lot. "It helps when your intelligence comes from a bona fide psychic."
"Quite," said Simon.
"Of course," Steve went on. "That's the point where we'd normally open up with the M16s and a truckload of Claymore mines. But in this case," he added with a self-satisfied smile, "I thought a well-designed security exit would do the trick." The two men glanced at each other and laughed out loud. Then Steve caught sight of the chopper in his mirror, and a more serious mood descended once more. They were not in the clear yet.
"Control to helicopter N27484, come in, please."
27 here, Control, go ahead.
"Ground unit has lost visual on target. Stay tight on target until car one can reacquire."
"Will do, Control. Any word yet on authorization to detain?"
"None as yet, 27. The director has been informed. We should have an answer in the next few minutes."
"Jesus," swore the helicopter's co-pilot. "They've gone right to the top. This must be the real deal."
"Will do, Control," said the pilot into his microphone. "Target has just turned onto West Broward Boulevard. Looks like he's heading for the highway."
"Understood, 27. Control out."
Steve turned north onto Highway 95, driving as fast as he could without drawing any additional unwanted attention. Beside him, Simon was craning his neck round in an attempt to see the chopper.
"You think we've lost it?" he asked.
"Not a chance," said Steve, "but we need to before that Volvo can get back on our tail."
"And can we?"
"Oh yes,"
said Steve with a smile, which, despite the concern on his face, told just how much he was enjoying this.
How?
Asked Simon.
Patience, boy, said Steve. Just another mile.
A few minutes later, and Steve switched to the inside lane, while ahead of them loomed a vast 10-lane overpass. Simon had a sudden insight into what Steve had in mind, and he could feel the anticipation in the ex-soldier sitting beside him. But then another more disturbing image came to him. Everything was not as Steve thought it was. Something was wrong.
Steve, said Simon, as they closed on the overpass.
Not now, Simon, said Steve distractedly. But, Steve, not now, snapped Steve. The Chevy slipped under the overpass, and Steve brought them to an abrupt halt on the verge beside the highway. Ahead of them, a bright red Hyundai was parked well up on the verge. However, pulled up close behind it was a considerably less shiny pickup truck, the drivers of which seemed to have taken an unhealthy interest in the unoccupied Hyundai.
Shit, breathed Steve, slumping back in his seat.
I tried to tell you, offered Simon. Steve paused for a second. He grabbed his overnight bag from the back seat and thrust it into Simon's lap.
Take this, he said, and stay in the car.
Using the pickup to conceal his approach, Steve closed quickly on the Hyundai. One guy was sitting in the driver's seat, the other was leaning in through the door. Neither would see him coming. Steve made his move.
Can I help you, gentlemen? Said Steve confidently,
as he came up beside the bright red rental car that he had parked here just a couple of hours before. The reaction from the men was startling. The man leaning in the driver's door straightened up suddenly, and Steve found himself looking down the barrel of a Glock 9mm handgun.
Control to helicopter N27484, come in, please.
27 here, Control. Go ahead.
Car 1 is now mobile. ETA on your position, 4 minutes.
Roger that, Control.
Target has stopped under the overpass at West Sunrise Bull. 1 minute, 27,
cut in the female voice. There was a pause of several seconds before the voice of Control returned.
Be advised, 27. Authorization has been granted. I repeat, authorization to detain subjects has been granted. Car 1 will be at West Sunrise Overpass in 4 minutes.
Steve sighed as the barrel of the gun came to a halt just inches from his face. But his sigh was one of annoyance and not of fear. He should have anticipated that even a city as shiny as Fort Lauderdale had its seedier side. The individual holding the gun had the hard, gaunt face of a man who was no stranger to Florida's judicial system. White, unshaven, and grubby-looking, he was of slight build and a good deal shorter than Steve, while the man in the driver's seat cast an altogether larger shadow. For a moment, the man seemed unnerved by the lack of reaction from Steve. He looked into Steve's eyes, and the gun's barrel wavered slightly. Behind him, Steve heard the door of the Chevy open as Simon disobeyed his command to stay in the car. The carjacker's eyes flicked past Steve's shoulder, and in that instant, Steve's hands lashed out with blinding speed. In the blink of an eye, he had disarmed the carjacker and turned the gun on its owner.
Easy now, man,
beseeched the carjacker, quailing before the gun that was now pointed at his head. The gun was rock steady in Steve's hand.
You, out of the car, said Steve to the man in the driver's seat, and out climbed a great hulk of a man in torn overalls that were thick with oil and grime.
Over by the truck, Steve ordered the two men, and over his shoulder.
Simon, get in the car, he called.
Simon moved quickly round to the far side of the Hyundai, but he hesitated to get inside. His heart was pounding, not because of the scene being played out before him, but because he could feel their pursuers getting closer.
Steve, they're coming, he said. I know, Simon, now get in the car.
The two carjackers hovered edgily near their pickup, still no more than 10 feet from Steve. Anger had replaced fear in their mean, reckless minds, and Steve could see they were beginning to doubt whether he would actually use the gun. He knew he would not, but he could not take it with him, and he was damned if he was going to leave it for them. Quickly, he grabbed the barrel of the gun, popped the round out of the chamber,
ejected the magazine, and disassembled the gun. Then he threw the parts into a nearby storm drain. The carjackers were less than pleased.
"That was a mistake, friend," said the small, wiry man, producing a knife from nowhere and starting towards Steve. Meanwhile, the big guy reached into the pickup's cab and pulled out a large pickaxe handle.
"Get in the car, Simon," said Steve, as the smaller of the two men closed on him.
Simon did not move as the violence began, and the time slowed to a crawl. As the knife flashed towards Steve, he blocked the attack with his left hand and slapped the skinny man in the throat with his right. The slap appeared ineffectual, but the man's body tightened with a spasm, and he fell, twitching, to the floor. Steve took a step forward to meet the downward blow of the axe handle, as the big fellow launched a mighty overhead swing. He caught the descending club, his hands closing over those of the heavier man, and with a savage twist, Steve flipped him onto his back. There was a grunt and the sound of something snapping. Then, before the big man could regain his feet, Steve crouched down behind him, one arm going round his neck, the other round the back of his head. His left hand was clasped firmly in the crook of his right arm. The headlock was secure, and then he began to squeeze. The big man was strong, but Steve held him down and did not let go.
"Steve!"
protested Simon, when he saw what was happening. But still, Steve did not release his hold. He just squeezed and squeezed until suddenly the big man went limp in his grasp, and Steve dropped him in the dirt. Then, without a backward glance,
"Simon, get in the fucking car!"
Finally, seeing the truth of what had just happened, Simon jumped in the car and barely had chance to close the door before the wheels spun noisily in the verge.
"You didn't kill him,"
stated Simon, as he reached back to pull on his seatbelt. Steve kept his foot to the floor, looking for a gap in the traffic.
"Of course I didn't kill him,"
he said, sounding somewhat insulted. He pulled back onto the main road, and by the time the Hyundai emerged from the overpass, it was moving at the same speed as the rest of the traffic on the highway.
"Believe me," added Steve, checking his rear-view mirror,
"it takes a lot longer than 30 seconds to strangle a man. I just cut off the blood supply to his brain. He'll come round soon, feeling happy as Larry." Steve remained in the inside lane and took the exit immediately after the overpass.
"But did you break his wrist?" insisted Simon.
"Well, he shouldn't have been so fat," said Steve. The slip road curved round a small circular lake, bringing them up onto West Sunrise Boulevard, and passing directly over the Chevy that now lay abandoned under the bridge.
"What about the other guy?"
"Jiu-jitsu move," said Steve. "A Japanese master gave us a demonstration in the regiment. Don't ask me how it works, but if you get it right, they're out for a few minutes, wake up with a headache."
"And you got it right, didn't I just?" said Steve, with an immodest grin.
Simon smiled at this flash of bravado. Steve had earned it. He had done enough to secure their escape, enough and no more. Simon settled back in his seat. Their excursion to America was over. He'd done what he came to do. Now it was time to leave the bright sunshine and return to the UK, where the shadows waited to engulf him. The novelty and adrenaline of the day had proved a useful distraction, but now it was time to go back. And Simon could feel the fear lurking on the edge of perception, threatening to poison his resolve and crush his will in its merciless jaws. With a weary sigh, Simon turned his face to the window. Steve noticed the sudden change in Simon's mood. He felt a surge of concern, but he sensed that this was a personal battle that Simon needed to face, and he remained silent. He maneuvered across the lanes of traffic, heading for the left-hand filter lane that would bring them back onto Highway 95 going south. Meanwhile, 1,000 feet above them, a helicopter circled the overpass, waiting for a blue Chevy Cobalt to emerge, and, as a silver Volvo disappeared beneath the overpass, a bright red Hyundai cruised south, heading for the airport.
Chapter 16. Friday, March the 4th.
Lucifer felt cheated.
The delusions of normal life had kept him too long from the accused. Now the heretic was close to death and had not yet been cleansed. He hung from the wall still, his torn hands encrusted with blood, his naked body pale and slack, his head hanging forward in oblivious stupor. Only the faint rasping grate of his breathing and the occasional delirious moan suggested that he was anything more than a corpse. No, this would not do at all. Those in dominion would not be appeased. The Inquisition must be consummated. The heretic must meet his end with open eyes, must confess his sins as the breath of life was taken from him. The heretic must wake before he is allowed to die. The late evening skies over England were a world away from the wide, sunlit blue of Florida. The low, dark clouds illuminated with a lurid orange glow from the lights of the city. Steve could not say that he was pleased to be back. The only message waiting on his mobile was from his bank manager. A deposit of £15,000 should be enough to prevent the bank from foreclosing on the house immediately, but they might still insist on the sale of the property to repay the remainder of the outstanding debt. No, their Virgin Atlantic 747 was not the only thing to have come down to earth with a bump, and Steve turned moodily to see if Simon had finished the call he was making. "Your girlfriend?" he asked, when Simon finally joined him outside Terminal 2 of Manchester Airport. "No," replied Simon, putting away his mobile phone, the smile on his face still lingering from the call. "Actually, it was a woman I have not spoken to before." "Well, you seem to be getting on well enough," said Steve, sourly. "Turns out we've got a lot in common," said Simon. Steve snorted and Simon's smile softened. He knew that Steve was only feeling bitter because he had not heard from Christine and could not bring himself to phone her. Being away from his family, even for a few days, felt like an eternity to Steve, but he did not want to call until he had something to offer, something to tell Christine that might make a difference to their awful predicament, and that meant seeing this job with Simon through. "Just a few more days," thought Steve. "Just a few more days and life can return to normal. Bollocks," Steve chided himself. "We're going to lose the house, maybe the cottage too. And on top of that, my wife and daughter think I'm some kind of violent monster. Life is never going to be normal again." "Here's our bus," said Simon, breaking Steve's despairing train of thought and regarding him with penetrating grey eyes. Simon had his own reasons for dreading their return to the UK. He knew there was no escaping destiny, not unless you were willing to let someone else pay the price. The bus ferried them quickly to the long-stay car park, and Steve disembarked first, his eyes scanning the deserted rows of vehicles before Simon stepped off the bus. Despite the anxieties tumbling through his mind, Steve's senses remained alert for any potential threat to Simon. For his part, Simon enjoyed the sense of security, even though he knew it was just an illusion. In the eerie brightness of the towering lamps, they made their way to Steve's BMW. They did not see it at first, hidden as it was by a large white transit van parked next to it. "Where next?" asked Steve, as he made his way round to the driver's side. "My flat," replied Simon, hovering by the passenger's door. 74 Freshfield Road, Altrincham." His words trailed off as his chest felt suddenly strained. His shoulders burned with a rending pain, and he struggled to draw a breath as the fear seeped like black oil into his mind. Once again, the heretic was waking up. Lucifer took a fistful of the heretic's hair, lifted his head and drew back his arm to strike a waking blow. Then he paused, glancing from the heretic's form up to the inverted image of Christ the Deceiver. The symmetry was pleasing, but one detail was missing. Lucifer walked over to the altar, opened an inlaid wooden box, and took out a small, short-bladed dagger.
The dagger was not of conventional design. The stubby handle was designed to sit in the palm of the hand, with the blade extending between the fingers. Such blades were known as fist daggers, or push knives. Protruding from Lucifer's massive fist, the short 3-inch blade looked insignificant, but it would be more than sufficient to wake the heretic. Lucifer returned to the dying man, glanced up at the inverted crucifix for reference, then stabbed the heretic between the ribs of his right side. Then, as the heretic gasped and choked his way back into